expressed goals in Gravesend's curriculum, where the whole boy was the proposed result of the 4-year program of study. Dan became the best of those faculty found at a prep school. He was not only a spirited, good teacher, but he believed that it was a hardship to be young, that it was more difficult to be a teenager than a grown-up, an opinion not widely held among grown-ups and rarely held among the faculty members at a private school, who more frequently look upon their charges as the privileged louts of the luxury class, spoiled brats in need of discipline. Dan Needham, although he encountered at Gravesend Academy many spoiled brats in need of discipline, simply had more sympathy for people under 20 than he had for people his own age and older, although he increased his sympathy for the elderly, who he believed were suffering a second adolescence and, like the boys at Gravesend, required special care. "Your grandmother is getting old," Dan told me. "She's suffered losses. Her husband, your mother, and Lydia, although neither your grandmother nor Lydia knew it, was possibly your grandmother's closest friend. Ethel is no better company than a fire hydrant. If your grandmother loves Liberace, don't fault her for that. Don't be such a snob. If someone makes her happy, don't complain," Dan said. But if it was tolerable to be grandmother's age and adore Liberace, it was intolerable that Owen Meany should also love that simpering piano key smile. "I'm sick of how smart Owen thinks he is," I said to Dan. "If he's so smart, how can he like Liberace at his age?" "Owen is smart," Dan said. "He's smarter than even he knows. But he is not worldly," Dan added. "God knows, in his family, what terrible superstitions he's grown up with. His father is an uneducated mystery, and no one knows the measure of his mother's mental problems. She's in such a lunatic state we can't even guess how insane she is. Maybe Owen likes Liberace because Liberace couldn't exist in Gravesend. Why does he think he'd be so happy in Sawyer Depot?" Dan asked me. "Because he's never been there." I thought Dan was right. But Dan's theories about Owen were always a little too complete. When I told Dan that Owen remained convinced he had seen the exact date of his own death, and that he refused to tell me what the special day was, Dan too neatly put that problem to rest along with the superstitions Owen's parents had subjected him to. I couldn't help thinking that Owen was more creative and more responsible than that. And if Dan was one of the gifted and tirelessly unselfish faculty members at the Academy, his sincere devotion to the goal of the whole boy may have blinded him to the faults of the school, and especially to the many flawed members of the faculty and the administration. Dan believed that Gravesend Academy could rescue anyone. All that Owen needed was to survive until he was old enough to enter the Academy. Owen's naturally good mind would mature when confronted with the academic challenges. Owen's superstitions would vanish in the company of the Academy's more worldly students. Like many dedicated educators, Dan Needham had made education his religion. Owen Meany lacked only the social and intellectual stimulation that a good school could provide. At Gravesend Academy, Dan was sure, the brute stupid influence of Owen's parents would be washed clean away, as cleanly as the ocean at Little Boar's Head could wash the quarry dust from Owen's body. My Aunt Martha and Uncle Alfred couldn't wait for Noah and Simon to be old enough to attend Gravesend Academy. The Eastmans, like Dan, believed in the powers of a good private school education. Specifically, in the case of Noah and Simon, in the power to rescue those two daredevils from the standard fates of rural, North Country boys, the marriage of driving fast on the back roads and beer, and the trailer park girls in the back seats of those cars, those girls who successfully conspired to get pregnant before their high school graduations. Like many boys who are sent off to private schools, my cousins Noah and Simon had a wildness within them that couldn't be safely contained by their homes or their communities, They had dangerous edges in need of blunting. Everyone suspected that the rigors of a good school would have the desired dulling effect on Noah and Simon. Gravesend Academy would assault them with a host of new demands of impossible standards. The sheer volume, if not the value, of the homework would tire them out, and everyone knew that tired boys were safer boys. The numbing routine, the strict attentions paid to the dress code, the regulations regarding only the most occasional and highly chaperoned encounters with the female sex, all this would certainly civilize them. Why my Aunt Martha and Uncle Alfred were less concerned with civilizing Hester remains a mystery to me. That Gravesend Academy did not admit girls in those days should not have influenced the Eastmans' decision to send or not to send Hester off to a private school. There were plenty of private schools for girls, and Hester was in as much need of rescuing from the wildness within her and from the rural North Country rituals of her sex as Noah and Simon were in need of saving. But in this interim period of time, when Noah and Simon and Owen and I were all waiting to be old enough to attend the academy, Hester began to resent that there were no plans being made for her salvation. The idea that she was not in need of rescuing would surely have insulted her, and the notion that my aunt and uncle might have considered her beyond saving would have hurt her in another way.
"Either way," said Owen Meany, "that's when Hester went on the warpath."
"What warpath?" Grandmother asked Owen. But Owen and I were careful not to discuss Hester with my grandmother. A new bond had developed between Owen and Grandmother because of Liberace. They also watched lots of old movies together and encouraged each other's constant comments. It was Grandmother's appreciation of Owen's commentary, which was as ripe with complaint as her own, that enlisted my grandmother's support of Owen as Gravesend Academy material.
"Just what do you mean you think you might not go to the academy?" she asked him.
"Well, I know I'll get in, and I know I'll get a full scholarship, too,"
Owen said.
"Of course you will," my grandmother said.
"But I don't have the right kind of clothes,"
Owen said.
"All those coats and ties and dress shirts and shoes?"
"Do you mean they don't make them in your size?" Grandmother asked him.
"Nonsense. One just has to go shopping in the right places."
"I mean my parents can't afford those kind of clothes,"
Owen said. We were watching an old Alan Ladd movie on the early show. It was called Appointment with Danger, and Owen thought it was ridiculous that all the men in Gary, Indiana, wore suits and hats.
"They used to wear them here," my grandmother said,
but probably they never wore them at the Meany Granite Quarry. Jack Webb, before he was the good cop in Dragnet, was a bad guy in Appointment with Danger. He was, among his other endeavors, attempting to murder a nun. This gave Owen the shivers. The movie gave my grandmother the shivers, too, because she recalled that she had seen it at the Idaho in 1951, with my mother.
"The nun will be all right, Owen," she told him.
"It's not the idea of murdering her that gives me the shivers,"
Owen explained.
"It's the idea of nuns, in general."
"I know what you mean," my grandmother said. She harbored her own misgivings about the Catholics.
"What would it cost to have a couple of suits and a couple of jackets and a couple of pairs of dress pants and shirts and ties and shoes? You know, the works,"
Owen asked.
"I'm going to take you shopping myself," Grandmother told him. "You let me worry about what it will cost. Nobody needs to know what it costs."
"Maybe in my size it's not so expensive,"
Owen said. And so, even without my mother alive to urge him, Owen Meany agreed that he was Gravesend Academy material. The Academy agreed, too. Even without Dan Needham's recommendation, they would have admitted Owen with a full scholarship. He was obviously in need of a scholarship, and he had all A's at Gravesend Junior High School. The problem was, though Dan Needham had legally adopted me and I therefore had the privileged status of a faculty son,
The Academy was reluctant to accept me. My junior high school performance was so undistinguished that the Academy admissions officers advised Dan to have me attend the ninth grade at Gravesend High School. The Academy would admit me to their ninth grade class the following year, when they said it would be easier for me to make the adjustment because I would be repeating the ninth grade. I had always known I was a weak student. This was less a blow to my self-esteem than it was painful for me to think of Owen moving ahead of me. We wouldn't be in the same class. We wouldn't graduate together. There was another, more practical consideration, that in my senior year, I wouldn't have Owen around to help me with my homework. That was a promise Owen had made to my mother, that he would always help me with my homework. And so, before Grandmother took Owen shopping for his Academy clothes, Owen announced his decision to attend the ninth grade at Gravesend High School, too. He would stay with me. He would enter the Academy the following year. He could have skipped a grade, yet he volunteered to repeat the ninth grade with me. Dan convinced the admissions officers that although Owen was academically quite advanced, it would also be good for him to repeat a grade, to be a year older as a ninth grader, because of his physical immaturity, Dan argued. When the admissions officers met Owen, of course, they agreed with Dan. They didn't know that a year older, in Owen's case, didn't mean that he'd be a year bigger. Dan and my grandmother were quite touched by Owen's loyalty to me. Hester, naturally, denounced Owen's behavior as queer. Naturally, I loved him, and I thanked him for his sacrifice. But in my heart, I resented his power over me.
"Don't give it another thought," he said. "We're pals, aren't we? What are friends for? I'll never leave you."
Toronto, February 5th, 1987. Liberace died yesterday. He was 67. His fans had been maintaining a candlelit vigil outside his Palm Springs mansion, which was formerly a convent. Wouldn't that have given Owen the shivers? Liberace had revised his former opposition to homosexuality.
"If you swing with chickens, that is your perfect right," he said.
Yet he denied the allegations in a 1982 palimony suit that he had paid for the sexual services of a male employee, a former valet and live-in chauffeur. There was a settlement out of court. And Liberace's manager denied that the entertainer was a victim of AIDS. Liberace's recent weight loss was the result, the manager said, of a watermelon-only diet. What would my grandmother and Owen Meany have said about that?
"Liberace!" Owen would have cried. "Who would have believed it possible? Liberace killed by watermelons!"
It was Thanksgiving, 1954, before my cousins visited Gravesend and saw Grandmother's TV at 80 Front Street for themselves. Noah had started at the Academy that fall, so he'd watch television with Owen and me on occasional weekends, but no judgment on the culture around us could ever be complete without Simon's automatic approval of every conceivable form of entertainment, and Hester's similarly automatic disapproval.
"Neat," Simon said.
He also thought that Liberace was neat.
"It's shit, all of it," said Hester. "Until everything's in color and the color's perfect, TV's not worth watching."
But Hester was impressed by the energy of Grandmother's constant criticism of nearly everything she saw. That was a style Hester sought to imitate, for even shit was worth watching if it afforded one the opportunity to elaborate on what sort of shit it was. Everyone agreed that the movie reruns were more interesting than the actual TV programs. Yet in Hester's view, the movies selected were too old. Grandmother liked them old. The older the better. But she disliked most movie stars. After watching Captain Blood, she announced that Errol Flynn was no brains, all chest. Hester thought that Olivia de Havilland was cow-eyed. Owen suggested that pirate movies were all the same.
Stupid sword fights, he said. And look at the clothes they wear. If you're going to be fighting with swords, it's stupid to wear loose, baggy shirts. Of course, your shirts are going to get all slashed to pieces.
Grandmother complained that the choice of movies wasn't even seasonal. What was the point of showing It Happens Every Spring in November? No one is thinking about baseball at Thanksgiving, and It Happens Every Spring is such a stupid baseball movie that I think I could watch it every night and even fail to be reminded of my mother's death. Rayma Land is a college professor who becomes a phenomenal baseball player after discovering a formula that repels wood. How could this remind anyone of anything real?
Honestly, who thinks up these things? Grandmother asked.
Peckerheads, said Hester, who was forever expanding her vocabulary.
If Gravesend Academy had begun the process of saving Noah from himself, we could scarcely tell. It was Simon who seemed subdued, perhaps because he had missed Noah during the fall and was overwhelmed by the instant renewal of their athletic rivalry. Noah was experiencing considerable academic difficulties at the academy, and Dan Needham had several long heart-to-heart talks with Uncle Alfred and Aunt Martha. The Eastmans decided that Noah was intellectually exhausted. The family would spend that Christmas holiday on some recuperative beach in the Caribbean.
In the relaxing setting of Captain Blood,
Owen observed. Owen was disappointed that the Eastmans were spending Christmas in the Caribbean. Another opportunity to go to Sawyer Depot had eluded him. After Thanksgiving, he was depressed. And, like me, he was thinking about Hester. We went to the Idaho for the usual fare at the Saturday matinee, a double feature, Treasure of the Golden Condor, wherein Cornell Wilde is a dashing 18th-century Frenchman seeking hidden Mayan riches in Guatemala, and Drumbeat, wherein Alan Ladd is a cowboy and Audrey Dalton is an Indian. Between tales of ancient treasure and scalping parties, it was repeatedly clear to Owen and me that we lived in a dull age, that adventure always happened elsewhere and long ago. Tarzan fit this formula, and so did the dreaded biblical epics. These, in combination with his Christmas pageant experiences, contributed to the newly sullen and withdrawn persona that Owen presented to the world at Christ Church. That the Wiggins had actually liked the robe made up Owen's mind. Whether he ever got to go to Sawyer Depot for Christmas or not, he would never participate in another nativity. I'm sure his decision did not upset the Wiggins greatly, but Owen was unforgiving on the subject of biblical epics in general and the robe in particular. Although he thought that Gene Simmons was
pretty, like Hester.
He also thought that Audrey Dalton, in Drumbeat, was
like Hester if Hester had been an Indian.
Beyond all three having dark hair, I failed to see any resemblance. The robe, to be fair, had hit Owen and me one Saturday afternoon at the Idaho with special force. My mother had been dead less than a year, and Owen and I were not comforted to see Richard Burton and Gene Simmons walk off to their deaths quite so happily. Furthermore, they appeared to exit the movie and life itself by walking up into the sky. This was especially offensive. Richard Burton is a Roman tribune who converts to Christianity after crucifying Christ. Both Burton and Gene Simmons take turns clutching Christ's robe a lot.
What a big fuss about a blanket, Owen said. That's so Catholic, he added, to get very religious about objects.
This was a theme of Owen's, the Catholics and their adoration of
objects.
Yet Owen's habit of collecting objects that he made, in his own way,
religious,
was well known. I had only to remember my armadillo's claws. In all of Gravesend, the object that most attracted Owen's contempt was the stone statue of Mary Magdalene, the reformed prostitute who guarded the playground of St. Michael's, the parochial school. The life-sized statue stood in a meaningless cement archway.
meaningless because the archway led nowhere. It was a gate without a place to be admitted to. It was an entrance without a house. The archway, and Mary Magdalene herself, overlooked the rutted macadam playground of the schoolyard, a surface too broken up to dribble a basketball on. The bent and rusted basket hoops had long ago been stripped of their nets, and the foul lines had been erased or worn away with sand. It was a forlornly unattended playground on weekends and school holidays. It was used strictly for recesses during school days, when the parochial students loitered there. They were unmoved to play many games. The stern look of Mary Magdalene rebuked them. Her former line of work and her harsh reformation shamed them. For although the playground reflected an obdurate disrepair, the statue itself was whitewashed every spring, and even on the dullest, grayest days, despite being dotted here and there with birdshit and occasional stains of human desecration, Mary Magdalene attracted and reflected more light than any other object or human presence at St. Michael's. Owen looked upon the school as a prison to which he was nearly sent. For had his parents not renounced the Catholics, St. Michael's would have been Owen's school. It had an altogether bleak, reformatory atmosphere. Its life was punctuated by the sounds of an adjacent gas station, the bell that announced the arriving and departing vehicles, the accounting of the gas pumps themselves, and the multifarious din from the mechanics laboring in the pits. But over this unholy, unstudious, unsuitable ground, the stone Mary Magdalene stood her guard. Under her odd cement archway, she at times appeared to be tending to an elaborate but crudely homemade barbecue. At other times, she seemed to be a goalie, poised in the goal. Of course, no Catholic would have fired a ball or a puck or any other missile at her. If the parochial students themselves were tempted, the grim, alert presence of the nuns would have discouraged them. And although the Gravesend Catholic Church was in another part of town, the shabby salt box where the nuns and some other teachers at St. Michael's lived was positioned like a guardhouse at a corner of the playground in full view of Mary Magdalene. If a passing Protestant felt inclined to show the statue some small gesture of disrespect, the vigilant nuns would exit their guardhouse on the fly, their black habits flapping with the defiant rancorousness of crows. Owen was afraid of nuns.
"They're unnatural," he said.
But what, I thought, could be more
unnatural
than the squeaky falsetto of the granite mouse, or his commanding presence, which was so out of proportion to his diminutive size? Every fall, the horse chestnut trees between Tan Lane and Garfield Street produced many smooth, hard, dark brown missiles. It was inevitable that Owen and I should pass by the statue of Mary Magdalene with our pockets full of chestnuts. Despite his fear of nuns, Owen could not resist the target that the holy goalie presented. I was a better shot, but Owen threw his chestnuts more fervently. We left scarcely any marks on Mary Magdalene's ground-length robe, on her bland, snowy face, or on her open hands, outstretched in apparent supplication, yet the nuns, in a fury that only religious persecution can account for, would attack us. Their pursuit was erratic, their shrieks like the cries of bats surprised by sunlight. Owen and I had no trouble outrunning them.
"Penguins!"
Owen would cry as he ran. Everyone called nuns penguins. We'd run up Cass Street to the railroad tracks and follow the tracks out of town. Before we reached Maiden Hill, or the quarries, we would pass the Fort Rock farm and throw what remained of our chestnuts at the Black Angus cattle grazing there. Despite their threatening size and their blue lips and tongues, the Black Angus wouldn't chase us as enthusiastically as the penguins, who always gave up their pursuit before Cass Street. And every spring, the swamp between Tan Lane and Garfield Street produced a pond full of tadpoles and toads. Who hasn't already told you that boys of a certain age are cruel? We filled a tennis ball can with tadpoles, and, under the cover of darkness, poured them over the feet of Mary Magdalene. The tadpoles, those that didn't turn quickly into toads, would dry up and die there. We even slaughtered toads and indelicately placed their mutilated bodies in the holy goalie's upturned palms, staining her with amphibian gore. God forgive us. We were such delinquents only in these few years of adolescence before Gravesend Academy could save us from ourselves. In the spring of 57, Owen was especially destructive to the helpless swamp life of Gravesend and to Mary Magdalene. Just before Easter, we'd been to the Idaho, where we suffered through Cecil B. DeMille's The Ten Commandments, the life of Moses, represented by Charlton Heston undergoing various costume changes and radical hairstyles.
"It's another male nipple movie," Owen said.
And indeed, in addition to Charlton Heston's nipples, there is evidence of Yul Brynner and John Derrick, and even Edward G. Robinson having nipples, too. That the Idaho should show the Ten Commandments so close to Easter was another example of what my grandmother called the poor seasonal taste of nearly everyone in the entertainment business. That we should see the exodus of the chosen people on the eve of our Lord's Passion and Resurrection was outrageous.
"All that Old Testament harshness when we should be thinking about Jesus," as Owen put it.
The parting of the Red Sea especially offended him.
"You can't take a miracle and just show it," he said indignantly. "You can't prove a miracle. You just have to believe it. If the Red Sea actually parted, it didn't look like that," he said. "It didn't look like anything. It's not a picture anyone can even imagine."
But there wasn't logic to his anger. If the Ten Commandments made him cross, why take it out on Mary Magdalene and a bunch of toads and tadpoles? In these years before we attended Gravesend Academy, Owen and I were educated primarily by what we saw at the Idaho and on my grandmother's television. Who hasn't been educated in this slovenly fashion? Who can blame Owen for his reaction to the Ten Commandments? Almost any reaction would be preferable to believing it. But if a movie as stupid as The Ten Commandments could make Owen Meany murder toads by throwing them at Mary Magdalene, a performance as compelling as Bette Davis's in Dark Victory could convince Owen that he, too, had a brain tumor. At first, Bette Davis is dying and doesn't know it. Her doctor and her best friend won't tell her.
"They should tell her immediately,"
Owen said anxiously. The doctor was played by George Brent. "He could never do anything right anyway," Grandmother observed. Humphrey Bogart is a stableman who speaks with an Irish accent. It was the Christmas of 56, and we were watching a movie made in 1939. It was the first time Grandmother had permitted us to watch The Late Show. At least, I think it was The Late Show. After a certain evening hour, or whenever it was that my grandmother began to feel tired, she called everything The Late Show. She felt sorry for us, because the Eastmans were spending another Christmas in the Caribbean. Sawyer Depot was a pleasure slipping into the past for me. For Owen, it was becoming mere wishful thinking. "You'd think that Humphrey Bogart could learn a better Irish accent than that," my grandmother complained. Dan Needham said that he wouldn't give George Brent a part in a production of The Gravesend Players. Owen added that Mr. Fish would have been a more convincing doctor to Bette Davis, but Grandmother argued that Mr. Fish would have his hands full as Bette Davis's husband. Her doctor eventually gets to be her husband, too. "Anyone would have his hands full as Bette Davis's husband," Dan observed. Owen thought it was cruel that Bette Davis had to find out she was dying all by herself. But Dark Victory is one of those movies that presumes to be instructive on the subject of how to die. We see Bette Davis accepting her fate gracefully. she moves to Vermont with George Brent and takes up gardening, cheerfully living with the fact that one day, suddenly, darkness will come.
"This is very sad,"
Owen cried.
"How can she not think about it?"
Ronald Reagan is a vapid young drunk. "She should have married him," Grandmother said. "She's dying and he's already dead." Owen said that the symptoms of Betty Davis's terminal tumor were familiar to him. "Owen, you don't have a brain tumor," Dan Needham told him.
"Betty Davis doesn't have one either," Grandmother said. "But I think Ronald Reagan has one."
"Maybe George Brent, too," Dan said.
"You know the part about the dimming vision?"
Owen asked.
"Well, sometimes my vision dims, just like Betty Davis's."
"You should have your eyes examined, Owen," Grandmother said.
"You don't have a brain tumor," Dan Needham repeated.
"I have something," said Owen Meany.
In addition to watching television, Owen and I spent many nights backstage with the Gravesend Players, but we rarely watched the performances. We watched the audiences. We repopulated those bleacher seats at that Little League game in the summer of 53. Gradually, the stands were filling. We had no doubts about the exact placement of the Kenmores or the Dowlings. Owen disputed my notion that Maureen Early and Caroline O'Day were in the top row. He
saw
them nearer the bottom. And we couldn't agree about the Brinker Smiths.
"The British never watch baseball,"
Owen said. But I always had an eye for Ginger Brinker Smith's fabled voluptuousness. I argued that she had been there, that I saw her.
"You wouldn't have looked twice if she had been there. Not that summer,"
Owen insisted.
"You were too young. And besides, she'd just had the twins. She was a mess."
I suggested that Owen was prejudiced against the Brinker Smiths ever since their strenuous lovemaking had battered him under their bed. But for the most part, we agreed about who had been at the game and where they had been sitting. Morrison, the mailman, we had no doubt, had never watched a game, and poor Mrs. Merrill, despite how fondly the baseball season must have reminded her of the perpetual weather of her native California, was never a fan either. We were not sure about the Reverend Mr. Merrill. We decided against his being there, on the grounds that we had rarely seen him anywhere without his wife. We were sure the Wiggins had not been there. They were often in attendance, but they displayed such a boorish enthusiasm for every pitch that if they'd been at that game, we would have noticed them. Since it had been a time when Barb Wiggins still thought of Owen as cute, she would have rushed to console him for his unfortunate contact with the faded ball, and Rector Wiggin would have bungled some rites over my mother's prostrate form or pounded my shaking shoulders with manly camaraderie. As Owen put it,
"If the Wiggins had been there, they would have made a spectacle of themselves. We would never have forgotten it."
Despite how exciting is any search for a missing parent, however mindless the method, Owen and I had to admit that so far we'd discovered a rather sparse and uninteresting lot of baseball fans. It never occurred to us to question whether the town's ardent Little League followers were also steady patrons of the Gravesend Players.
"There's one thing you must never forget,"
Owen told me.
"She was a good mother. If she thought the guy could be a good father to you, you'd already know him."
"You sound so sure," I said.
"I'm just warning you," he said. "It's exciting to look for your father, but don't expect to be thrilled when you find him. I hope you know we are not looking for another Dan."
I didn't know. I thought Owen presumed too much. It was exciting to look for my father, that much I knew.
"The lust connection,"
as Owen called it, also contributed to our ongoing enthusiasm for
the father hunt,
as Owen called our overall enterprise.
"Every time you get a boner, try to think if you remind yourself of anyone you know."
That was Owen's interesting advice on the matter of my lust being my most traceable connection to my missing father.
As for lust, I had hoped to see more of Hester, now that Noah and Simon were attending Gravesend Academy, but in fact, I saw her less. Noah's academic difficulties had caused him to repeat a year. Simon's first year had been smoother, probably because it thrilled Simon to have Noah demoted to his grade in school. Both boys, by the Christmas of 57, were juniors at Gravesend, and so thoroughly involved in what Owen and I presumed to be the more sophisticated activities of private school life that I saw only slightly more of them than I saw of Hester. It was rare that Noah and Simon were so bored at the academy that they visited 80 Front Street, not even on weekends, which they increasingly spent with their doubtless more exotic classmates. Owen and I assumed that, in Noah's and Simon's eyes, we were too immature for them. Clearly, we were too immature for Hester, who, in response to Noah being forced to repeat a grade, had managed to have herself promoted. She encountered few academic difficulties at Sawyer Depot High School, where, Owen and I imagined, she was terrorizing faculty and students alike. She had probably gone to some effort to skip a grade, motivated, as she always was, to get the better of her brothers. Nonetheless, all three of my cousins were scheduled to graduate with the class of 59, when Owen and I would be completing our first and lowly ninth grade year at the academy. We would graduate with the class of 62. It was humiliating to me. I'd hoped that one day I would feel more equal to my exciting cousins, but I felt I was less equal to them than I'd ever been. Hester, in particular, seemed beyond my reach.
"Well, she is your cousin. She should be beyond your reach," Owen said. "Also, she's dangerous. You're probably lucky she's beyond your reach. However," Owen added, "if you're really crazy about her, I think it will work out. Hester would do anything to drive her parents nuts. She'd even marry you."
"Marry me?" I cried. The thought of marrying Hester gave me the shivers.
"Well, that would drive her parents around the bend," Owen said. "Wouldn't it?"
It would have. And Owen was right. Hester was obsessed with driving her parents and her brothers crazy. To drive them to madness was the penalty she exacted for all of them treating her like a girl. According to Hester, Sawyer Depot was boys' heaven. My Aunt Martha was a fink of womanhood. She bowed to Uncle Alfred's notion that the boys needed a private school education, that the boys needed to expand their horizons. Hester would expand her own horizons in directions conceived to educate her parents regarding the errors of their ways. As for Owen's idea that Hester would go to the extreme of marrying her own cousin, if that could provide Aunt Martha and Uncle Alfred with an educational wallop, it was inconceivable to me. "I don't think that Hester even likes me," I told Owen. He shrugged.
"The point is," said Owen Meany, "Hester wouldn't necessarily marry you because she liked you."
Meanwhile, we couldn't even manage to get ourselves invited to Sawyer Depot for Christmas. After their holidays in the Caribbean, the Eastmans had decided to stay at home for the Yuletide of 57. Owen and I got our hopes up, but, alas, they were quickly dashed. We were not invited to Sawyer Depot. The reason the Eastmans weren't going to the Caribbean was that Hester had been corresponding with a black boatman who had proposed a rendezvous in the British Virgin Islands. Hester had involved herself with this particular black boatman the previous Christmas in Tortola, when she'd been only 15. Naturally, how she had involved herself was not made explicitly clear to Owen and me. We had to rely on those parts of the story that my Aunt Martha had reported to Dan, substantially more of the story than she had reported to my grandmother, who was of the opinion that a sailor had made a pass at poor Hester, an exercise in crudeness that had made Hester want to stay home. In fact, Hester was threatening to escape to Tortola.
She was also not speaking to Noah and Simon, who had shown the black boatman's letters to Uncle Alfred and Aunt Martha, and who had fiercely disappointed Hester by not introducing her to a single one of their Gravesend Academy friends. Dan Needham described the situation in the form of a headline, "Teenage Traumas Run Wild in Sawyer Depot." Dan suggested to Owen and me that we were better off to not involve ourselves with Hester. How true. But how we wanted to be involved in the thrilling, real-life sleaziness that we suspected Hester was in the thick of. We were in a phase, through television and the movies, of living only vicariously. Even faintly sordid silliness excited us if it put us in contact with love. The closest that Owen Meany and I could get to love was a front-row seat at the Idaho. That Christmas of 57, Owen and I were 15. We told each other that we had fallen in love with Audrey Hepburn, the shy bookstore clerk and funny face. But we wanted Hester. What we were left with was a sense of how little, in the area of love, we must be worth. We felt more foolish than Fred Astaire, dancing with his own raincoat. And how worried we were that the sophisticated world of Gravesend Academy would esteem us even less than we esteemed ourselves. Toronto, April 12, 1987. A rainy Palm Sunday. It is not a warm spring rain, not a seasonal rain, as my grandmother liked to say. It is a raw, cold rain, a suitable day for the passion of our Lord Jesus Christ. At Grace Church on the Hill, the children and the acolytes stood huddled in the narthex. Holding their palm fronds, they resembled tourists who'd landed in the tropics on an unseasonably cold day. The organist chose Brahms for the processional, "O Welt, ich muss dich lassen," "O World, I must leave you." Owen hated Palm Sunday. The treachery of Judas, the cowardice of Peter, the weakness of Pilate.
"It's bad enough that they crucified him," Owen said, "but they made fun of him, too."
Canon Mackey read heavily from Matthew, how they mocked Jesus, how they spit on him, how he cried, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" I find that Holy Week is draining. No matter how many times I have lived through his crucifixion, my anxiety about his resurrection is undiminished. I am terrified that this year it won't happen, that year it didn't. Anyone can be sentimental about the Nativity. Any fool can feel like a Christian at Christmas. But Easter is the main event. If you don't believe in the resurrection, you're not a believer.
"If you don't believe in Easter," Owen Meany said, "don't kid yourself. Don't call yourself a Christian."
For the Palm Sunday recessional, the organist chose the usual Alleluias. In a chilling drizzle, I crossed Russell Hill Road and went in the service entrance of the Bishop Strawn School. I passed through the kitchen, where the working women and the boarders, whose turn it was to help with the Sunday meal, all spoke to me. The headmistress, the Reverend Mrs. Catherine Keeling, sat in her usual head-of-table position among the house mothers. About 40 boarders, the poor girls who had no local friends to ask them home for the weekend, and the girls who were happy to stay at school, sat around the other tables. It is always a surprise to see the girls not in their uniforms. I know it's a great relief to them to wear their uniforms day in, day out, because they don't have to worry about what to wear. But they are so lazy about how they wear their uniforms. They don't have much experience in dressing themselves, that when they have a choice, when they're allowed to wear their own clothes, they appear wholly less sophisticated, less worldly, than they appear in their uniforms. In the 20 years that I have been a teacher at the Bishop Strawn School, the girls' uniforms haven't changed very significantly. I've grown rather fond of them. If I were a girl, of any age, I would wear a midi, a loosely tied necktie, a blazer with my school crest, knee socks, which the Canadians used to call knee highs, and a pleated skirt. When they kneel, it used to be the rule that the skirt should just touch the floor. But for Sunday boarders' lunch, the girls wear their own clothes. Some of them are so badly dressed, I fail to recognize them. They make fun of me for that, naturally. Some of them dress like boys, others like their mothers or like the floozies they see in movies or on TV. As I am, routinely, the only man in the dining room for Sunday boarders' lunch, perhaps they dress for me. I've not seen my friend, and technically my boss, Catherine Keeling, since she delivered her last baby. She has a large family. She's had so many children, I've lost count. But she makes an effort to sit at the house mother's table on Sundays, and she chatters amiably to the weekend girls. I think Catherine is terrific, but she is too thin. And she always is embarrassed when I catch her not eating, although she should get over the surprise. I'm a more consistent fixture at the house mother's table for Sunday boarders' lunch than she is. I don't take time off to have babies. But there she was on Palm Sunday with mashed potatoes and stuffing and turkey heaped upon her plate. "Turkey rather dry, is it?" I asked. The ladies routinely laughed. Catherine typically blushed. When she's wearing her clerical collar, she looks slightly more underweight than she actually is. She's my closest friend in Toronto, now that Canon Campbell is gone, and even though she's my boss, I've been at Bishop Strawn longer than she has. Old Teddy Bear Kilgore, as we called him, was principal when I was hired. Canon Campbell introduced us. Canon Campbell had been the chaplain at Bishop Strawn before they made him rector of Grace Church on the Hill. I couldn't have had anyone recommend me for a job at Bishop Strawn who was more connected to the school than Canon Campbell, not even old Teddy Bear Kilgore himself. I still tease Catherine about those days. What if she'd been headmistress when I applied for a job? Would she have hired me? A young man from the States in those Vietnam years, a not unattractive young man and without a wife? Bishop Strawn has never had many male teachers, and in my 20 years of teaching these young girls, I have occasionally been the only male teacher at the school. Canon Campbell and old Teddy Bear Kilgore don't count. They were not male in the threatening sense. They were not potentially dangerous to young girls. Although the canon taught scripture and history, in addition to his duties as chaplain, he was an elderly man, and he and old Teddy Bear Kilgore were married up to their ears, as Catherine Keeling likes to say. Old Teddy Bear did ask me if I was attracted to young girls, but I must have impressed him that I would take my faculty responsibilities seriously, and that I would concern myself with those young girls' minds and not their bodies. "And have you?" Catherine Keeling likes to ask me. How the house mothers titter at the question, like Liberace's live audiences of long ago. Catherine is a much more jubilant soul than my grandmother, but she has a certain twinkling sarcasm, and the proper elocution, the good diction, that reminds me of grandmother. They would have liked each other. Owen would have liked the Reverend Mrs. Keeling, too. I've misled you if I've conveyed an atmosphere of loneliness at Sunday boarders' lunch. Perhaps the boarders feel acutely lonely then, but I feel fine. Rituals are comforting. Rituals combat loneliness. On Palm Sunday, there was much talk about the weather. The week before, it had been so cold that everyone commented on the annual error of the birds. Every spring, at least in Canada, some birds fly north too soon. Thousands are caught in the cold. They return south in a reverse migration. Most common were tales of woe concerning robins and starlings. Catherine had seen some killdeer flying south. I had a common snipe story that impressed them all. We'd all read the Globe and Mail that week. We'd loved the story about the turkey vultures who iced up and couldn't fly. They were mistaken for hawks and taken to a humane society for thawing out. There were 9 of them, and they threw up all over their handlers. The Humane Society could not have been expected to know that turkey vultures vomit when attacked. Who would guess that turkey vultures are so smart? I've also misled you if I've conveyed an atmosphere of trivia at Sunday Boarders' lunch. These lunches are important to me. After the Palm Sunday lunch, Catherine and I walked over to Grace Church and signed up for the all-night vigil on the notice board in the narthex. Every Maundy Thursday, the vigil of prayer and quiet is kept from 9 o'clock that evening until 9 o'clock in the morning of Good Friday. Catherine and I always choose the hours no one else wants. We take the vigil from 3 to 5 o'clock in the morning, when Catherine's husband and children are asleep and don't need her. This year, she cautioned me, I may be a little late if the 2 o'clock feeding is much later than 2 o'clock. She laughs, and her endearingly stick-thin neck looks especially vulnerable in her clerical collar. I see many parents of the Bishop Strong girls. They are so smartly dressed. They drive Jaguars. They never have time to talk. I know that they dismiss the Reverend Mrs. Catherine Keeling as a typical headmistress type. Catherine is not the sort of woman they would look at twice. But she is wise and kind and witty and articulate, and she does not bullshit herself about what Easter means.
Easter means what it says, said Owen Meany.
At Christ Church on Easter Sunday, Rector Wigan always said, Hallelujah, Christ is risen. And we, the people, we said, The Lord is risen indeed. Hallelujah. Toronto, April 19, 1987. A humid, summery Easter Sunday. It does not matter what prelude begins the service. I will always hear Handel's Messiah, and my mother's not-quite-trained soprano singing, I Know That My Redeemer Liveth. This morning, in Grace Church on the Hill, I sat very still, waiting for that passage in John. I knew what was coming. In the old King James Version, it was called a sepulcher. In the Revised Standard Version, it is just a tomb. Either way, I know the story by heart. Now, on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb early, while it was still dark, and saw that the stone had been taken away from the tomb. So she ran and went to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one whom Jesus loved, and said to them, They have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him. I remember what Owen used to say about that passage. Every Easter, he would lean against me in the pew and whisper into my ear,
This is the part that always gives me the shivers.
After the service today, my fellow Torontonians and I stood in the sun on the church steps, and we lingered on the sidewalk along Lonsdale Road. The sun was so welcome and so hot. We were childishly delighted by the heat, as if we'd spent years in an atmosphere as cold as the tomb where Mary Magdalene found Jesus missing. Leaning against me and whispering into my ear, in a manner remindful of Owen Meany, Catherine Keeling said, Those birds that flew north and then south, today they're flying north again. Hallelujah, I said. I was thinking of Owen when I added, He is risen. Hallelujah, said the Reverend Mrs. Keeling. That the television was always on at 80 Front Street ceased to tempt Owen and me. We could hear Grandmother talking either to herself or to Ethel or directly commenting to the TV, and we heard the rise and fall of the studio-made laughter. It was a big house. For 4 years, Owen and I had the impression that there was always a forbidding gathering of grown-ups chattering away in a distant room. My grandmother sounded as if she were the haranguing leader of a compliant mob, as if, it were her special responsibility to berate her audience and to amuse them, almost simultaneously, for they rewarded her humor with their punctual laughter, as if they were highly entertained that the tone of voice she used on them was uniformly abusive. Thus, Owen Meany and I learned what crap television was, without ever thinking that we hadn't come to this opinion by ourselves. Had my grandmother allowed us only 2 hours of TV a day, or not permitted us more than 1 hour on a school night, we probably would have become as slavishly devoted to television as the rest of our generation. Owen started out loving only a few things he saw on television, but he saw everything, as much of everything as he could stand. After 4 years of television, though, he watched nothing but Liberace and the old movies. I did, or tried to do, everything Owen did. For example, in the summer of 58, when we were both 16, Owen got his driver's license before I got mine, not only because he was a month older, but because he already knew how to drive. He'd taught himself with his father's various trucks. He'd been driving on those steep, loopy roads that ran around the quarries that pockmarked most of Maiden Hill. He took his driver's test on the day of his 16th birthday, using his father's tomato red pickup truck. In those days, there was no driver education course in New Hampshire, and you took your test with a local policeman in the passenger seat. The policeman told you where to turn, when to stop, or back up, or park. The policeman, in Owen's case, was Chief Ben Pike himself. Chief Pike expressed concern regarding whether or not Owen could reach the pedals or see over the steering wheel. But Owen had anticipated this. He was mechanically inclined, and he'd raised the seat of the pickup so high that Chief Pike hit his head on the roof. Owen had slid the seat so far forward that Chief Pike had considerable difficulty cramming his knees under the dashboard. In fact, Chief Pike was so physically uncomfortable in the cab of the pickup that he cut Owen's test fairly short.
"He didn't even make me parallel park," Owen said.
He was disappointed that he was denied the opportunity to show off his parallel parking abilities. Owen Meany could slip that tomato red pickup into a parking space that would have been challenging for a Volkswagen Beetle. In retrospect, I'm surprised that Chief Pike didn't search the interior of the pickup for that instrument of death he was always looking for. Dan Needham taught me to drive. It was the summer Dan directed Julius Caesar in the Gravesend Academy summer school, and he would take me for lessons every morning before rehearsals. Dan would drive me out the Swayze Parkway and up Maiden Hill. I practiced on the back roads around the quarries. The roads on which Owen Meany learned to drive were good enough for me, and Dan judged it safer for me off the public highways, although the Meany Granite Company vehicles flew around those roads with reckless abandon. The quarrymen were fearless drivers, and they trucked the granite and their machinery at full throttle. But in the summer, the trucks raised so much dust that Dan and I had warning when one was coming. I always had time to pull over, while Dan recited his favorite Shakespeare from Julius Caesar. "Cowards die many times before their deaths. The valiant never taste of death but once." Whereupon, Dan would grip the dashboard and tremble while a dynamite truck hurtled past us. Of all the wonders that I yet have heard, it seems to me the most strange that men should fear, seeing that death, a necessary end, will come when it will come. Owen, too, was fond of that passage. When we saw Dan's production of Julius Caesar later that summer, I had passed my driver's test. Yet in the evenings when Owen and I would drive down to the boardwalk and the casino at Hampton Beach together, we took the tomato red pickup, and Owen always drove. I paid for the gas. Those summer nights of 1958 were the first nights I remember feeling grown up. We'd drive half an hour from Gravesend for the fleeting privilege of inching along a crowded, gaudy strip of beachfront, looking at girls who rarely looked at us. Sometimes they looked at the truck. We could drive along this strip only two or three times before a cop would motion us over to the side of the street, examine Owen's driver's license in disbelief, and then suggest that we find a place to park the truck and resume our looking at girls on foot on either the boardwalk or on the sidewalk that threaded the arcades. Walking with Owen Meany at Hampton Beach was ill-advised. He was so strikingly small, he was teased and roughed up by the delinquent young men who tilted the pinball machines and swaggered in the heated vicinity of the girls in their cotton candy-colored clothes. And the girls, who rarely returned our glances when we were secure in the Meany Granite Company pickup, took very long and giggling looks at Owen when we were on foot. When he was walking, Owen didn't dare look at the girls. Therefore, when a cop would inevitably advise us to park the truck and pursue our interests on foot, Owen and I would drive back to Gravesend. Or we would drive to a popular daytime beach, Little Boar's Head, which was beautifully empty at night. We'd sit on the seawall and feel the cool air off the ocean and watch the phosphorescence sparkle in the surf. Or we would drive to Rye Harbor and sit on the breakwater and watch the small boats slapping on the ruffled pond-like surface. The breakwater itself had been built with the slag, the broken slabs, from the Meany Granite Quarry.
"Therefore, I have a right to sit here,"
Owen always said. No one, of course, ever challenged our being there. Even though the girls ignored us that summer, that was when I noticed that Owen was attractive to women, not only to my mother. It is difficult to say how he was attractive or why, but even when he was 16, even when he was especially shy or awkward, he looked like someone who had earned what grasp of the world he had. I might have been particularly conscious of this aspect of him because he had truly earned so much more than I had. It was not just that he was a better student or a better driver or so philosophically sure of himself. Here was someone I had grown up with and had grown used to teasing. I had picked him up over my head and passed him back and forth. I had derided his smallness as surely as the other children had, and yet, suddenly, by the time he was 16, he appeared in command. He was more in command of himself than the rest of us. He was more in command of us than the rest of us. And with women, even with those girls who giggled when they looked at him, you sensed how compelled they were to touch him. And by the end of the summer of 58, he had something astonishing for a 16-year-old. In those days, before all this ardent and cosmetic weightlifting, he had muscles. To be sure, he was tiny, but he was fiercely strong, and his sinewy strength was as visible as the strength of a whippet. Although he was frighteningly lean, there was already something very adult about his muscular development. And why not? After all, he'd spent the summer working with granite. I hadn't even been working. In June, he'd started as a stonecutter. He spent most of the working day in the monument shop, cutting with the grain.
"With the rift,"
as he called it, using the wedge and feathers. By the middle of the month, his father had taught him how to saw against the grain. The sawyers cut up the bigger slabs, and they finished the gravestones with what was called a diamond wheel, a circular blade impregnated with diamonds. By July, he was working in the quarries. He was often the signalman, but his father apprenticed him to the other quarrymen, the channel bar drillers, the derrickmen, the dynamiters. It seemed to me that he spent most of the month of August in a single remote pit, 175 feet deep, a football field in diameter. He and the other men were lowered to work in a grout bucket. Grout is waste, the rubble of broken rock that is raised from the pit all day long. At the end of the day, they bring up the men in the bucket. Granite is a dense, heavy stone. It weighs close to 200 pounds per cubic foot. Ironically, even though they worked with the diamond wheel, most of the sawyers had all their fingers. But none of the quarrymen had all their fingers. Only Mr. Meany had all his.
"I'll keep all mine, too," Owen said. "You've got to be more than quick. You've got to feel when the rock's going to move before it moves. You've got to move before the rock moves."
Just the slightest fuzz grew on his upper lip. Nowhere else did his face show traces of a beard, and the faint mustache was so downy and such a pale gray color that I first mistook it for pulverized granite, the familiar rock dust that clung to him. Yet his face, his nose, the sockets for his eyes, his cheekbones, and the contours of his jaw, had the gaunt definition that one sees in the faces of 16-year-olds only when they are starving. By September, he was smoking a pack of Camels a day. In the yellow glow of the dashboard lights, when we went out driving in the pickup at night, I would catch a glimpse of his profile with the cigarette dangling from his lips. His face had a permanent adult quality. Those mother's breasts, he'd once unfavorably compared to my mother's breasts, were beneath his interest now, although Barb Wiggins were still
"too big,"
Mrs. Webster's were still
"too low,"
and Mrs. Merrill's only
"very funny."
While Ginger Brinker Smith, as a younger mother, had claimed our attention, we now, for the most part, coolly assessed our peers.
"The two Carolines,"
Caroline Perkins and Caroline O'Day, appealed to us, although the breasts of Caroline O'Day were devalued in Owen's view by her Catholicism. Maureen Early's bosom was judged to be
"perky."
Hannah Abbott's breasts were
"small, but shapely."
Irene Babson, who had given Owen the shivers as long ago as when my mother's bosom was under review, was now so out of control as to be
"simply scary."
Deborah Perry, Lucy Dearborn, Betsy Bickford, Sarah Tilton, Polly Farnham, to their names and to the contours of their young breasts, Owen Meany would inhale a Camel deeply. The summer wind rushed through the rolled-down window of the pickup. When he exhaled, slowly, through his nostrils, the cigarette smoke was swept away from his face, dramatically exposing him as if he were a man miraculously emerging from a fire.
"It's too soon to tell, with most 16-year-olds,"
Owen said, sounding already worldly enough for any conversation he might encounter at Gravesend Academy, although we both knew that the problem with the 16-year-old girls who interested us was that they dated 18-year-olds.
"By the time we are 18, we'll get them back," Owen said. "And we'll get all the 16-year-olds, too, the ones we want,"
he added, inhaling again and squinting into the oncoming headlights. By the fall of 58, when we entered Gravesend Academy, Owen seemed very sophisticated to me. The wardrobe my grandmother had acquired for him was more stylish than anything you could buy in New Hampshire. My clothes all came from Gravesend, but grandmother took Owen shopping in Boston. It was his first time on a train, and, since they were both smokers, they rode in the smoking coach together and shared their nearly constant and critical comments on the attire of their fellow passengers on the Boston and Maine, and on the comparative courtesy, or lack thereof, of the conductors. Grandmother outfitted Owen almost entirely at Filene's and Jordan Marsh, one of which had a small gentleman's department, which the other called a small man's special needs. Jordan Marsh and Filene's were pretty flashy labels by New Hampshire standards.
"This is not bargain basement stuff,"
Owen said proudly. For our first day of classes, Owen showed up looking like a small Harvard lawyer. He was not intimidated by the bigger boys because he had always been smaller, and he was not intimidated by the older boys because he was smarter. He saw immediately a crucial difference between Gravesend the town and Gravesend the academy. The town paper, the Gravesend newsletter, reported all the news that was decent and believed that all things decent were important. The school newspaper, which was called The Grave, reported every indecency that could escape the censorship of the paper's faculty advisor and believed that all things decent were boring. Gravesend Academy embraced a cynical tone of voice, savored a criticism of everything that anyone took seriously. The students hallowed, above everyone else, that boy who saw himself as born to break the rules, as destined to change the laws. And to the students of Gravesend, who thus chafed against their bonds, the only accepted tone was caustic, was biting, mordant, bitter, scathing sarcasm, the juicy vocabulary of which Owen Meany had already learned from my grandmother. He had mastered sarcasm in much the same way he had become a smoker. He was a pack-a-day man in a month. In his first fall term at Gravesend, the other boys nicknamed him Sarcasm Master. In the lingo of those times, everyone was a something master. Dan Needham tells me that this is one of those examples of student language that endures. At Gravesend Academy, the term is still in use. I have never heard it at Bishop Strawn. But Owen Meany was Sarcasm Master in the way that Big Buster York was Barf Master, that Skipper Hilton was Zit Master, that Morris West was Nose Master, that Duffy Swain, who was prematurely bald, was Hair Master, that George Fogg, the hockey player, was Ice Master, that Horace Brigham, a ladies' man, was Snatch Master. No one found a name for me. Among the editors of The Grave, in which Owen published the first essay he was assigned in English class, Owen was known as The Voice. His essay was a satire on the source of food in the school dining hall.
"Mystery meat,"
Owen titled the essay, and the unrecognizable gray steaks we were served weekly. The essay, which was published as an editorial, described the slaughter and refrigeration of an unidentified, possibly prehistoric beast that was dragged to the underground kitchen of the school in chains.
"In the dead of night."
The editorial and the subsequent weekly essays that Owen published in The Grave were ascribed not to Owen Meany by name, but to The Voice, and the text was printed in uniform uppercase letters.
"I'm always going to be published in capitals,"
Owen explained to Dan and me,
"because it will instantly grab the reader's attention, especially after The Voice gets to be a kind of institution."
By the Christmas of 1958, in our first year at the Academy, that is what Owen Meany had become, The Voice.
"A kind of institution."
Even the search committee, appointed to find a new headmaster, was interested in what The Voice had to say. Applicants for the position were given a subscription to The Grave. The snide, sneering precocity of the student body was well represented in its pages, and best represented by the capitals that commanded one's gaze to Owen Meany. There were some old curmudgeons on the faculty, and some young fuddy-duddies, too, who objected to Owen's style. And I don't mean that they objected only to his outrageous capitalization. Dan Needham told me that there had been more than one heated debate in faculty meeting concerning the marginal taste of Owen's blanket criticism of the school. Granted, it was well within a long-established tradition for Gravesend students to complain about the Academy, but Owen's sarcasm suggested to some a total and threatening irreverence. Dan defended Owen. But The Voice was a proven irritant to many of the more insecure members of the Gravesend community, including those far away but important subscribers to The Grave, concerned parents and alumni. The subject of concerned parents and alumni yielded an especially lively and controversial column for The Voice.
"What are they concerned about?"
Owen pondered.
"Are they concerned with our education, that it be both classical and timely? Or are they concerned that we might possibly learn more than they have learned, that we might inform ourselves sufficiently to challenge a few of their more hardened and idiotic opinions? Are they concerned about the quality and vigorousness of our education, or are they more superficially concerned that we might fail to get into the university or college of their choice?
Then there was the column that challenged the coat and tie dress code, arguing that it was
inconsistent to dress us like grown-ups and treat us like children.
And there was the column about required church attendance, arguing that
it ruins the proper atmosphere for prayer and worship to have the church, any church, full of restless adolescents who would rather be sleeping late or indulging in sexual fantasies or playing squash. Furthermore, requiring attendance at church, forcing young people to participate in the rituals of a belief they don't share, serves merely to prejudice those same young people against all religions and against sincerely religious believers. I believe that it is not the purpose of a liberal education to broaden and expand our prejudices.
And on and on. You should have heard him on the subject of required athletics.
Born of a brown shirt mentality, a concept embraced by the Hitler Youth.
And on the regulation that boarders were not allowed to enjoy more than 3 weekends off campus in a single term.
Are we so simple in the administration's view that we are characterized as content to spend our weekends as athletic heroes or fans of spectator sports? Is it not possible that some of us might find more stimulation at home, or at the home of a friend, or even at a girls' school? And I don't mean at one of those over-organized and charmlessly chaperoned dances.
The voice was our voice. He championed our causes. He made us proud of ourselves in an atmosphere that belittled and intimidated us. But his was also a voice that could criticize us. When a boy was thrown out of school for killing cats, he was ritualistically lynching cats that were pets of faculty families. We were quick to say how sick he was. It was Owen who reminded us that all boys, himself included, were touched by that same sickness.
"Who are we to be righteous?" he asked us. I have murdered tadpoles and toads. I've been a mass murderer of innocent wildlife.
He described his mutilations in a self-condemnatory, regretful tone, although he also confessed his slight vandalism of the sainted Mary Magdalene. I was amused to see that he offered no apologies to the nuns of St. Michael's. It was the tadpoles and toads he was sorry about.
What boy hasn't killed live things? Of course, it's sick to be a hangman of poor cats, but how is it worse than what most of us have done? I hope we've outgrown it, but does that mean we forget that we were like that? Do the faculty remember being boys? How can they presume to teach us about ourselves if they don't remember being like us? If this is a place where we think the teaching is so great, why not teach the kid that killing cats is sick? Why throw him out?
It would grow to be a theme of Owen's.
Why throw him out?
He would ask, repeatedly. When he agreed that someone should have been thrown out, he said so. Drinking was punishable by dismissal, but Owen argued that getting other students drunk should be a more punishable offense than solitary drinking. Also, that most forms of drinking were
not as destructive as the almost routine harassment of students who are not cool by students who think it is cool to be harshly abusive, both verbally abusive and physically intimidating. Cruel and deliberate mockery is worse than drinking. Students who bait and mercilessly tease their fellow students are guilty of what should be a more punishable offense than getting drunk. Especially in those instances when your drunkenness hurts no one but yourself.
It was well known that the voice didn't drink. He was black coffee meanie and pack-a-day meanie. He believed in his own alertness. He was sharp. He wanted to stay sharp. His column on The Perils of Drink and Drugs must have appealed even to his critics. If he was not afraid of the faculty, he was also not afraid of his peers. It was still only our ninth grade year, when Owen invited Hester to the senior dance. In Noah and Simon's graduating year, Owen Meany dared to invite their dreaded sister to their senior class dance.
"She'll just use you to meet other guys," Noah warned him. "She'll fuck our whole class and leave you looking at the chandelier," Simon told Owen.
I was furious with him. I wished I'd had the nerve to ask Hester to be my date. But how do you date your first cousin? Noah and Simon and I commiserated. As much as Owen had captured our admiration, he had risked embarrassing himself, and all of us, by being the instrument of Hester's debut at Gravesend Academy.
"Hester the molester," Simon repeated and repeated. "She's just a Sawyer Depot kind of girl," Noah said condescendingly.
But Hester knew much more about Gravesend Academy than any of us knew she knew. On that balmy spring weekend in 1959, Hester arrived prepared. After all, Owen had sent her every issue of The Grave. If she had once regarded Owen with distaste, she had called him queer and crazy and a creep. Hester was no fool. She could tell when a star had risen. And Hester was committed to irreverence. It should have been no surprise to Noah and Simon and me that the voice had won her heart. Whatever had been her actual experience with the black boatman from Tortola, the encounter had lent to Hester's recklessly blooming young womanhood a measure of restraint that women gain from only the most tragic entanglements with love. In addition to her dark and primitive beauty and a substantial loss of weight that drew one's attention to her full, imposing bosom and to the hardness of the bones in her somber face, Hester now held herself back just enough to make her dangerousness both more subtle and more absolute. Her wariness matured her. She had always known how to dress. I think it ran in the family. In Hester's case, she wore simple, expensive clothes, but more casually than the designer had intended, and the fit was never quite right. Her body belonged in the jungle, covered only essentially, possibly with fur or grass. For the senior dance, she wore a short black dress with spaghetti straps as thin as string. The dress had a full skirt, a fitted waist, and a deeply plunging neckline that exposed a broad expanse of Hester's throat and chest, a fetching background for the necklace of rose-gray pearls my Aunt Martha had given her for her 17th birthday. She wore no stockings and danced barefoot. Around one ankle was a black rawhide thong, from which a turquoise bauble dangled, touching the top of her foot. Its value could have been only sentimental. Noah implied that the Tortola boatman had given it to her. At the senior dance, the faculty chaperones and their wives never took their eyes off her. We were all enthralled. When Owen Meany danced with Hester, the sharp bridge of his nose fit perfectly in her cleavage. No one even cut in. There we were, in our rented tuxedos, boys more afraid of pimples than of war. But Owen's tux was not rented. My grandmother had bought it for him, and in its tailoring, in its lack of shine, in its touch of satin on its slim lapels, it eloquently spoke to the matter that was so obvious to us all, how the voice expressed what we were unable to say. Like all dances at the academy, this one ended under extreme supervision. No one could leave the dance early, and when one left and had escorted one's date to the visitor's dorm, one returned to one's own dorm and checked in precisely 15 minutes after having checked out of the dance. But Hester was staying at 80 Front Street. I was too mortified to spend that weekend at my grandmother's, with Hester as Owen's date, and so I returned to Dan's dorm with the other boys who marched to the school's rules. Owen, who had the day boys standing permission to drive himself to and from the academy, drove Hester back to 80 Front Street. Once in the cab of the tomato red pickup, Hester and Owen were freed from the regulations of the dance committee. They lit up. The smoke from their cigarettes concealed the assumed complacency of their expressions, and each of them lolled an arm out a rolled-down window as Owen turned up the volume of the radio and drove artfully away. With his cigarette, with Hester beside him, in his tux, in the high cab of that tomato-red pickup, Owen Meany looked almost tall. Other boys claimed that they did it in the bushes, between leaving the dance and arriving at their dorms. Other boys displayed kissing techniques in lobbies, risked copping a feel in coat rooms, defied the chaperone's quick censure of anything as vulgar as sticking a tongue in a girl's ear. But beyond the indisputable fact of his nose embedded in Hester's cleavage, Owen and Hester did not resort to either common or gross forms of public affection. And how he later rebuked our childishness by refusing to talk about her. If he did it with her, the voice was not bragging about it. He took Hester back to 80 Front Street, and they watched the late show together. He drove himself back to the quarry.
"It was rather late," he admitted.
"What was the movie?" I asked.
"What movie?"
"On the late show."
"Oh, I forget."
"Hester must have fucked his brains out," Simon said morosely. Noah hit him. "Since when does Owen forget a movie?" Simon cried. But Noah hit him again. "Owen even remembers the robe," Simon said. Noah hit him in the mouth, and Simon started swinging.
"It doesn't matter," Simon yelled. "Hester fucks everybody."
Noah had his brother by the throat.
"We don't know that," he said to Simon. "We think it," Simon cried. "It's okay to think it," Noah told his brother.
He rubbed his forearm back and forth across Simon's nose, which began to bleed.
"But if we don't know it, we don't say it." "Hester fucked Owen's brains out," Simon screamed.
Noah drove the point of his elbow into the hollow between Simon's eyes.
"We don't know that," he repeated.
But I had grown accustomed to their savage fights. They no longer frightened me. Their brutality seemed plain and safe alongside my conflicted feelings for Hester, my crushing envy of Owen. Once again, the voice put us in our places.
"It is hard to know, in the wake of the disturbing dance weekend, whether our esteemed peers or our esteemed faculty chaperones should be more ashamed of themselves. It is puerile for young men to discuss what degree of advantage they took of their dates. It is disrespectful of women, all this cheap bragging, and it gives men a bad reputation. Why should women trust us? But it is hard to say whether this boorish behavior is worse or better than the Gestapo tactics of our Puritan chaperones. The dean's office tells me that two seniors have received notice of disciplinary probation for the remainder of the term for their alleged overt indiscretions. I believe the two incidents fall under the punishable offense of morally reprehensible conduct with girls. At the risk of sounding prurient, I shall reveal the shocking nature of these two sins against the school and womankind. 1. A boy was found fondling his date in the trophy room of the gym. As the couple was fully dressed and standing at the time, it seems unlikely that a pregnancy could have resulted from their exchange. And although the gym is notorious for it, I'm sure they hadn't even exposed themselves sufficiently to risk an athlete's foot infection. 2. A boy was seen leaving the butt room in Bancroft Hall with his tongue in his date's ear. an odd and ostentatious manner in which to exit a smoking lounge, I will agree. But this degree of physical contact is also not known to result in a pregnancy. To my knowledge, it is even difficult to communicate the common cold by this method.
After that one, it became customary for the applicants, for the position of headmaster, to request to meet him when they were interviewed. The search committee had a student subcommittee available to interview each candidate, but when the candidates asked to meet the voice, Owen insisted that he be given
a private audience.
The issue of Owen being granted this privilege was the subject of a special faculty meeting where tempers flared. Dan said there was a movement to replace the faculty advisor to the grave. There were those who said that the pregnancy humor in Owen's column about the senior dance should not have escaped the advisor's censorship. But the faculty advisor to the grave was an Owen Meany supporter, Mr. Early, that deeply flawed thespian who brought to every role he was given in the Gravesend Players an overblown and befuddled sense of Lear-like doom, cried that he would defend the unsullied genius of the voice, if necessary, to the death. That would not be necessary, Dan Needham was sure, but that Owen was supported by such a boob as Mr. Early was conceivably worse than no defense at all. Several applicants for the headmaster position admitted that their interviews with the voice had been daunting. I'm sure that they were unprepared for his size, and when they heard him speak, I'm sure they got the shivers and were troubled by the absurdity of that voice communicating strictly in uppercase letters. One of the favored candidates withdrew his application. Although there was no direct evidence that Owen had contributed to the candidate's retreat, the man admitted there was a certain quality of accepted cynicism among the students that had depressed him. The man added that these students demonstrated an attitude of superiority and such a degree of freedom of speech as to make their liberal education too liberal. "Nonsense," Dan Needham had cried in the faculty meeting. "Owen Meany isn't cynical. If this guy was referring to Owen, he was referring to him incorrectly. Good riddance." But not all the faculty felt that way. The search committee would need another year to satisfy their search. The present headmaster cheerfully agreed, for the good of the school, to stall his retirement. He was all for the good of the school, the old headmaster, and it was his support of Owen Meany that, for a while, kept Owen's enemies from his throat.
"He's a delightful little fella," the headmaster said. "I wouldn't miss reading the voice, not for all the world."
His name was Archibald Thorndike, and he'd been headmaster forever. He'd married the daughter of the headmaster before him, and he was about as old school as a headmaster could get. Although the newer, more progressive-minded faculty complained about Archie Thorndike's reluctance to change a single course requirement, not to mention his views of the whole boy, the headmaster had no enemies. Old Thorny, as he was called, and he encouraged even the boys to address him as Thorny, was so headmasterly in every pleasing, comfortable, superficial way that no one could feel unfriendly toward him. He was a tall, broad-shouldered, white-haired man with a face as serviceable as an oar. In fact, he was an oarsman and an outdoorsman, a man who preferred soft, un-ironed trousers, maybe khakis or corduroys, and a tweed jacket with the elbow patches in need of a thread here or there. He went hatless in our New Hampshire winters and was such a supporter of our teams in the rawest weather that he wore a scar from an errant hockey puck as proudly as a merit badge. The puck had struck him above the eye while he'd tended the goal during the annual alumni varsity game. Thorny was an honorary member of several of Gravesend's graduating classes. He played every alumni game in the goal.
"Ice hockey's not a sissy sport," he liked to say.
In another vein, in defense of Owen Meany, he maintained,
"It is the well-educated who will improve society, and they will improve it, at first, by criticizing it, and we are giving them the tools to criticize it.
Naturally, as students, the brighter of them will begin their improvements upon society by criticizing us.
To Owen, old Archie Thorndike would sing a slightly different song.
It is your responsibility to find fault with me. It is mine to hear you out. But don't expect me to change. I'm not going to change. I'm going to retire. Get the new headmaster to make the changes. That's when I made changes, when I was new.
What changes did you make?
Owen Meany asked. That's another reason I'm retiring, old Thorny told Owen amiably. My memory's shot.
Owen thought that Archibald Thorndike was a blithering, glad-handing fool. But everyone, even the voice, thought that old Thorny was a nice guy.
Nice guys are the toughest to get rid of,
Owen wrote for the Grave. But even Mr. Early was smart enough to censor that. Then it was summer. The voice went back to work in the quarries. I don't think he said much down the pits, and I had my first job. I was a guide for the Gravesend Academy admissions office. I showed the school to prospective students and their parents. It was boring, but it certainly wasn't hard. I had a ring of master keys, which amounted to the greatest responsibility anyone had given me, and I had freedom of choice regarding which typical classroom I would show and which typical dormitory room. I chose rooms at random in Waterhouse Hall, in the vague hope that I might surprise Mr. and Mrs. Brinker Smith at their game of musical beds. But the twins were older now, and maybe the Brinker Smiths didn't do it with their former gusto. In the evenings, at Hampton Beach, Owen looked tired to me. I reported to the admissions office for my first guided tour at 10, but Owen was stepping into the grout bucket by 7 every morning. His fingernails were cracked, his hands were cut and swollen, his arms were tanned and thin and hard. He didn't talk about Hester. The summer of 59 was the first summer that we met with any success in picking up girls, or rather, Owen met with this success and he introduced the girls he met to me. We didn't do it that summer, at least I didn't, and to my knowledge, Owen never had a date alone.
It's a double date or it's nothing,
he'd tell one surprised girl after another.
Ask your friend or forget it.
And we were no longer afraid to cruise the pinball arcades around the casino on foot. Delinquent thugs would still pick on Owen, but he quickly established a reputation as an untouchable.
You want to beat me up?
He'd say to some punk.
You want to go to jail? You're so ugly you think I'll have trouble remembering your face?
Then he'd point to me.
You see him? Are you such an asshole you don't know what a witness is? Go ahead, beat me up.
Only one guy did, or tried. It was like watching a dog go after a raccoon. The dog does all the work, but the raccoon gets the better of it. Owen just covered up. He grabbed for hands and feet. He went for the fingers first, but he was content to tear off a shoe and go for the toes. He took a pounding, but he wrapped himself into a ball. He left no extremities showing. He broke the guy's pinky. He bent it so sharply that after the fight the guy's little finger pointed straight up off the back of his hand. He tore one of the guy's shoes off and bit his toes. There was a lot of blood, but the guy was wearing a sock. I couldn't see the actual damage, only that he had trouble walking. The guy was pulled off Owen by a cotton candy vendor. He was arrested shortly thereafter for screaming obscenities, and we heard he was sent to reform school because he turned out to be driving a stolen car. We never saw him on the beachfront again, and the word about Owen, on the strip, around the casino, and along the boardwalk, was that he was dangerous to pick a fight with. The rumor was that he'd bitten off someone's ear. Another summer, I heard that he'd blinded a guy with a popsicle stick. That these reports weren't exactly true did not matter at Hampton Beach. He was that little dude in the red pickup. He was the quarry worker. He carries some kind of tool on him. He was a mean little fucker. Watch out for him. We were 17. We had a sullen summer. In the fall, Noah and Simon started college out on the West Coast. They went to one of those California universities that no one on the East Coast can even remember the name of, and the Eastmans continued their folly of considering Hester as less of an investment. They sent her to the University of New Hampshire, where, as a resident, she merited in-state tuition.
"They want to keep me in their own backyard," was how Hester put it.
"They put her in our backyard,"
was how Owen put it.
The state university was only a 20-minute drive from Gravesend. That it was a better university than the tanning club that Noah and Simon attended in California was not an argument that impressed Hester. The boys got to travel. The boys got the more agreeable climate. She got to stay home. To New Hampshire natives, the state university, notwithstanding how basically solid an education it offered, was not exotic. To Gravesend Academy students with their elitist eyes on the Ivy League schools, it was a cow college, wholly beyond redemption. But in the fall of 59, when Owen and I began our 10th grade year at the academy, Owen was regarded as especially gifted by our peers because he was dating a college girl. That Hester was a cow college girl did not tarnish Owen's reputation. He was ladies' man, meanie. He was older woman master, and he was still and would always be the voice. He demanded attention, and he got it. Toronto, May 9th, 1987. Gary Hart, a former U.S. senator from Colorado, quit his campaign for the presidency after some Washington reporters caught him shacked up for the weekend with a Miami model. Although both the model and the candidate claimed that nothing immoral occurred, and Mrs. Hart said that she supported her husband, or maybe it was that she understood him, Mr. Hart decided that such intense scrutiny of his personal life created an intolerable situation for him and his family. He'll be back. Want to bet? In the United States, no one like him disappears for long. Remember Nixon? What do Americans know about morality? They don't want their presidents to have penises, but they don't mind if their presidents covertly arrange to support the Nicaraguan rebel forces after Congress has restricted such aid. They don't want their presidents to deceive their wives, but they don't mind if their presidents deceive Congress, lie to the people, and violate the people's constitution. What Mr. Hart should have said was that nothing unusually immoral had occurred, or that what happened was only typically immoral, or that he was testing his abilities to deceive the American people by deceiving his wife first, and that he hoped the people would see by this example that he was immoral enough to be good presidential material. I can just hear what the voice would have said about all this. A sunny day. My fellow Canadians in Winston Churchill Park have their bellies turned toward the sun. All the girls at Bishop Strawn are tugging up their middies and hiking up their pleated skirts. They are pushing their knee socks down around their ankles. The whole world wants a tan. But Owen hated the spring. The warm weather made him think that school was almost over, and Owen loved school. When school was over, Owen Meany went back to the quarries.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook, so please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.